Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 289 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we're delighted to commence a new season of our Location and the Writer series. In this instalment, specially selected for National Libraries Week, Tanya Hirschman explores the cornucopia of libraries offered by the great northern city of Manchester, including private and public collections, and modern trimmings including digital pianos and foosball tables. Then, Rick Stroud takes us to St James's Square and the quiet sanctuary of the London Library, a private and productive space beloved by writers and readers alike. First, here's Tanya Hirschman with Manchester, Library City.
I wake up thinking of libraries. I wake up thinking of the ones I dreamed in as a child, those book palaces, those universes of story. And then I remember the foosball table I discovered last week on the second floor of Manchester's Central Library. You know what I mean. A player stands at either end turning knobs so that rows of plastic footballers propel the ball down one end or another. Table football. Not what I'd expected to stumble on as I explored this public library, which, when it was opened by George V on the 17th of July 1934, my birthday as it happens, although 36 years before the fact, was the largest library in the country provided by a local authority, said the King. In 1852, 2 years after the passing of the Free Libraries Act, Manchester had been the first to establish a rate-supported public lending and reference library. This city has a history with libraries. There is so much more in the Central Library than the unexpected foosball table. I also did not expect all the pianos in the Henry Watson Music Library, there for the playing, with headphones of course, and which are being used as I wander past, a man mumbling to himself, 1-2, 1-2. There are computers everywhere now, and in the immensely grand and hushed Wolfson Reading Room, with its clock of gold, I remember how, once, soon after I moved to this city a few years ago, I was allowed to touch, with bare hands, the first edition of Newton's Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, 1687. Because this library is a resting place for one of the greatest collections of rare books in the world. Let's leave the Central Library for a while and take a slow 10-minute walk to one of its older sisters, the Portico, around the corner from the tram-filled St. Peter's Square, where the Central Library presides, is 213 years old and no foosball table here. Established as a private subscription library, we reach it up a small staircase and step into its domed main room. What do we see? We might have expected grandeur, stuffiness. But in fact, there is a buzz of activity, people chatting, drinks being brought in on trays. Libraries are not silent anymore. No one shushes you here. This library has fewer people, yes, and is smaller. But it is powerful, radical, alive and vibrant. I sit for a while with a coffee and observe. What you'll notice first when you walk in here is polite literature, one of the four section titles stenciled above the high shelves, the others being biography, voyages and travels, and fine arts. Oh, you might think, what does this mean? The Portico is ready with an answer in its polite literature booklet. When asked about this unfamiliar term, we have always tended to tell people that it is simply the literature that was read in the polite society of the Georgian era, and even glibly added that it is the sort of literature deemed sufficiently suitable for a wife or servant, paraphrasing the remark made by the chief prosecutor in the obscenity trial of Lady Chatterley's lover. This is not really the case, though, because amongst our polite literature shelves you can find some quite risque novels, a few books on witchcraft, philosophical and theological arguments that are not particularly polite. And when I interrupt James, the exhibition's organiser, as he slices off the edges of posters for display, to ask what his favourite book is, he says, A classical dictionary of the vulgar tongue by Francis Gross. He laughs. It is, weirdly, in the polite lit section, he says, but it is very impolite. The public are welcome here, but can't access most of the books, which are arranged on every wall around the room. In several display cases, there is an exhibit called The Threat of Democracy. The portico often has exhibitions combining works from their collections with new art and writing inspired by certain themes. I peek in between the cases to catch a glimpse of what's on the polite literature shelves. I see botanical Shakespeare, naturalists and paradise, extinct birds, forest scenery, essays on the microscope, the modern plumber and sanitary engineer. The entire portico library wouldn't fill one floor of its younger sibling, but it has a none too shabby 25,000 or so books, which are all out on the shelves. We have no storage space, James explains, and then asks if I'd like to see the reading room, which is past the point politely cordoned off, only for staff, members, and others with special privileges. It is no exaggeration to say that I fall in love with the reading room, smaller than the central libraries, but with everything I adore, books, more books, tables, armchairs, people reading, studying, thinking. When James tells me that if I am doing research, I can come here too, without the need to pay, just by emailing the right person, I almost swoon. I will be back, I say. In the central library, I surprise myself again, stumbling across a multi-faith prayer room. Unlike the portico, this is the centre of a network of libraries throughout the city, a hub not just for readers of all ages, but for the community. Here, in a corner of the lower ground floor, past the fiction and non-fiction, is the UK Visa and Citizenship Application Services. Here, the Ahmed Iqbal Race Relations Resource Centre. There are film archives and pods to watch the films in, an exhibition of women of action, and a display case of recently made placards calling for less waste and to clean our seas. There is a Lego club, which I would very much like to come to. Spring salads on offer in the cafe, even though it is already summer, and someone singing in the exhibition hall. In the business and IT centre, I overhear two women sitting at computers talking about shareholders. A man walks up the stairs, picks a newspaper from the rack, and finds himself a comfortable chair. This is a whole world. Both libraries have a strong sense of Manchesterness, a great pride in their city, as do their siblings, the John Rylands Library, which was given as a gift to the people of Manchester in 1900 and is part of the University of Manchester, and Cheetham's Library, the oldest public library in the English-speaking world, founded in 1653. This year, they are all commemorating the 200th anniversary of the Peterloo Massacre, when government forces charged a crowd of thousands of peaceful demonstrators in Manchester's St Peter's Field, demanding democracy, equality and reform. 18 people were killed, and their names are remembered in a pattern of red stars on the ground by the Central Library's main entrance. I bend down to look more closely. Margaret Downes, I read, Sarah Jones, Edmund Dawson, Martha Partington. Both the Central and Portico Libraries mix the old and the new, the written and the spoken words, art and writing, activism, discovery and innovation. But most of all, they are made of and for people. What are we looking for here? Asks one of the three young women who walk past me up the Central Library's grander staircase. Is there a better question to ask in a library? On one wall of the portico is a clock, but with north, south, east and west instead of hours and minutes. Where do you want to go today? Come in, sit down, let your mind wander.
That was Tanya Hirschman. You can find out more about Tanya on her website at www.tanyahirschman.com. That's Tanya, spelled T-A-N-I-A, and Hirschman with one N. Next, here's Rick Stroud on the London Library.
If you're in St. James's Square at about 9:15 on almost any morning, you'll probably be passed by number 10, the London Library. You'll see a group of us standing on the steps muttering quietly to each other, gossiping about our work and the events of the day. The same steps have felt the tread of the famous like Charles Dickens, Virginia Woolf, Winston Churchill, and Stanley Kubrick. But most readers aren't famous. They just love reading, writing, and using books. The steps we stand on lead to two fine mahogany doors with brass fittings. If you linger until 9:30, you will hear bolts sliding back as the doors are opened. Our conversation will stop as we tense for the polite stampede to get to a favourite desk. Once through the doors, the bustle of St. James's Square is replaced by the deep, warm, all-enveloping hush of the library. Some of us head up the wide, red-carpeted staircase, heading for the main reading room. A magnificent space, two stories high, its walls lined floor to ceiling with books. Others, including me, head for one of the many areas where computers can now be used. A quarter of an hour later, we're all at our desks and the daily routine of the library has begun. The London Library is a wonderful place and I use it almost every day. For me, the subscription works out at less than the price of a daily coffee in Starbucks. I first climbed the steps 26 years ago, proudly carrying my Apple Macintosh PowerBook 145B with 2 megabytes of RAM and 40 megabytes of hard drive storage. I carried it into a room which is now known as the Writer's Room. I don't know what it was called then, but it was the only room in the building where we were allowed to use computers, and there was no Wi-Fi. The room was furnished with a jumble of tables, and we had to scrabble under the desks to plug in our equipment. Today, there's Wi-Fi all over the building, and many areas have custom-designed desks with PowerPoints built in. When I first joined, I earned my living directing films, and the library was the place where I went to work on scripts, to think and mull over how I was going to approach whatever I was shooting next. 10 years ago, my life changed as I began to write my first book, The Book of the Moon. Since then, I have been lucky enough to publish 7 titles. At first, the change from directing to writing was a shock. The film set is a noisy place, full of hurly-burly, a mad sort of marketplace. I discovered that writing is a silent, solitary, and sometimes lonely occupation. I fell into the malaise that many writers suffer from, prevarication. I looked for any excuse to avoid putting pen to blank paper. I would feel a sudden irresistible desire to tidy my sock drawer, or a pressing need to make a cheese sandwich and a cup of tea and any number of other excuses not to get down to writing. The London Library proved a brilliant antidote to such folly. The sight of other writers and researchers hunched over their work, the gentle noise of fingers tapping computer keys, or the squeak of biros or scratch of fountain pens on paper is a huge incentive to get on with the scribbling. The library is a beautiful place to work. The temperature in the reading rooms is perfect, and everywhere there are books. Behind the reading rooms are the stacks, 17 miles of shelving, holding more than 1 million books, a collection which is growing at the rate of 6,000 books a year. You might say, so what? The British Library has 10 times that amount and is free. Yes, that's true, but the difference is that the London Library shelves are open. You can walk along them at your leisure and so introduce that essential element to your research, luck. On the way to find the book you think you urgently need, you might spot another one you did not know about, did not know you needed, until you pull it down and serendipity begins to work its magic. It happens to me almost every time I enter the stacks. The other great difference between the London Library and places like the Bodleian or the British Library is that you can borrow books and take them home. 10 at a time for 2 months at a time. One of the delightful idiosyncrasies of this haven for bibliophiles is its system of classification, which has something of Byzantium about it. White notices in the lifts attempt to guide the reader, telling us that fiction, A to R, and fiction, quarto, are somewhere in the maze of shelves on the second floor. The same notice tells us that on the fourth floor, via stairs from literature floor 3, can be found L, Wit and Humour. For those of us who find all this a bit too baffling, there are the librarians, a team of people working all over the building, quietly sorting, reshelving, cataloguing, and always ready to help the perplexed reader find the path to the right section. The most useful aid to finding a book is the library's online catalogue, known as Catalyst. When I first joined, the way to find a book was the old-fashioned way. I went to the physical catalogues where titles were stored on tens of thousands of much-fingered index cards held in row after row of wooden drawers. Books acquired in the 19th century were filed in enormous ledgers, each volume and its details entered in exquisite copperplate. Keeping track of what one had looked at and ordered was a task that required care and patience. Thanks to Catalyst, that's all changed. I don't use it to its full potential, but it will remember my searches and let me make electronic notes on what I have looked for, and even has a digital bookshelf that lets me keep tabs on what I'm using at any given time. Catalyst searches not only the library's store of books, but also that of any institution with which it has links. Some searches will throw up thousands of entries, not just books, but articles and everything from learned journals to popular magazines. I can search the catalogue and order books from home or anywhere else in the world. I remember having an idea when I was on holiday in Greece. Sitting by the shores of the Mediterranean, I logged onto the library website, found the titles I thought I needed and ordered them. They were waiting for me when I got to St. James's Square a fortnight later. I am now a trustee of the library and share a responsibility to make sure that it is in good heart and will be going strong for many decades to come. There are readers who think it should never change and that it should always remain as it has always done. They're wrong. The library building is in a constant state of flux. I look at photographs taken inside the building over the last 100 years and these show enormous change. Walls appear and disappear. Stairwells come and go. The wonderful reading room, which many consider sacrosanct, was once nearly twice its present size. At some time in the last 50 years, it was divided in two. Standing in either room, it is impossible to see that it has ever changed. The library is a very open and welcoming place and is always looking for ways to give more and more people the chance to enjoy its facilities. Perhaps our most important new initiative has been the Emerging Writers Programme. In this, its first year, there were 600 applicants. Library member and fellow trustee Daisy Goodwin, creator of the hit television series Victoria, chaired a committee of publishers, writers, arts administrators and literary agents to assess the candidates, who included aspiring poets, screenplay writers, historians, novelists and even an advertising copywriter. 38 were chosen and were given a free year's subscription to the library and became members of a mentoring and networking programme designed to help them make their way down the rocky road to getting published. We also have a system of bursaries for those who are finding the financial going a bit too much. Another new initiative is that we've started using the evenings to mount plays and events in the main reading room. Our first production was Dracula, based on the book by library member Bram Stoker, who researched and partly wrote it in the library. The performances were so successful that its four-week run was extended by a week. More plays are in the pipeline, as well as a programme of fortnightly events, sometimes in collaboration with Bloomsbury Publishing. We have plans to create an outreach and engagement room that will allow us to host speaker events, workshops and exhibitions. Elsewhere, we shall be providing spaces where readers can meet and share ideas over a cup of coffee or a glass of wine. For those who might struggle to get to London on a regular basis, there are now new types of membership at reduced cost, focusing on borrowing from the collection by post and accessing the digital library. For nearly 3 decades, the London Library has nourished my film work and my writing, providing me with a quiet space surrounded by books with all the facilities I need. Stephen Fry has gone on record saying that what the gym does for the body, the London Library does for the mind, and that the library is the place where books are born. Stephen is right. The library is an important cultural institution, not just in London, but throughout the country and increasingly in the world. Membership is open to all and its influence is growing all the time. Many fellows of the Royal Literary Fund are already members of the London Library, and it is an ambition of mine to strengthen and encourage links between our two organisations. I'm proud to be a member and a trustee and to play my part in seeing to it that the library will be thriving in another 200 years.
That was Rick Stroud. You can find out more about Rick on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 289, which was recorded and produced by Yasser Amir. Coming up in episode 290, Zoe Marriott speaks with Amanda Whittington about identity, diversity, and feminism in her young adult fantasy fiction. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.